This episode of Hodinkee Radio is proudly brought to you by Hodinkee Insurance. It's the fastest, easiest way to insure the watches you love. Get your quote now at hodinkee.com/insurance. Hey, it's me, James Stacey, and this week we're chatting all about the latest release from fan favorite Tudor, the Ranger. Essentially an update to the Ranger that was originally released in 2014, the new reference 79950 is a 39mm steel field watch with a rivet-free and T-fit-equipped bracelet and the same movement found in the ever-popular Black Bay 58. Despite being a very conventional design, it hits the core of the Tudor audience and is a major release for the brand in 2022. Joining me is Jack, who owns a previous-gen Ranger, and one Mark Kozlerich, who is a freelance photographer, photojournalist, and National Geographic explorer. Mark took the assignment to travel to London for the official Ranger launch, and the three of us dig into what the new Ranger is, what it isn't, and how it fits into the growing Tudor lineup. So here's the tune, and then the chat. All right, Mark, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show, and Jack returning. How are you guys doing?
Doing great. Thanks so much.
Doing good.
Yeah, I think this is going to be fun. It's not always that we get to talk about a new watch that's like deeply in my own kind of personal wheelhouse. I get a feeling, Mark, it is for you as well at a certain level. And Jack, you're actually an owner of the previous Ranger. So I think we're doing a good job taking a peek at the brand new 79950 reference Tudor Ranger. Mark, you went and covered this for Hodinkee. You got to go to London to the actual launch. Why don't you give us a little bit of background on what that was like and sort of what the new watch is and how Tudor's kind of explaining its existence in the line?
Yeah, it was a really cool experience. This is actually the first time that I've covered a release like this in person on the ground. And so I think there was just knowing that this was going to be something pretty big, although maybe not completely unexpected. I was a little worked up the night before. I didn't get to bed until about 5 a.m. And some of that was maybe jet lag and some of that was anticipation, but it was a pretty cool event. We arrived at the space and immediately walked into this area that was designed somewhat to look like an ice cave, although I will say the London heat from the summer sort of dispelled a little bit of that illusion. But one of the first things you saw when you walked in was this small-scale M29 Weasel-tracked vehicle that they used on this British North Greenland expedition that they were celebrating the day of the launch. And it was this little small-scale orange vehicle that was made by Studebaker for World War II, which was a pretty cool way to set the stage for the event. And as you made your way into the main room, there were all these historical displays, ephemera, advertisements from Tudor related to that exhibition, which had launched 70 years to the day. So, you know, with the teasing that they had done beforehand and the fact that this is not the first time that Tudor has used that exhibition, they went all the way back to advertisement in 1952 to 1954, but they've talked about the exhibition in their more recent history, and so it was a great opportunity to sort of set the stage for what would be coming.
Okay, and so you're there. They've got a whole kind of scene set up. They're kind of recreating some of the vibe of the Greenland expedition. What was it like when they dropped the watch? Were you able to immediately get your hands on one, or were you kind of in line to get a little bit closer to it as people took their kind of rough Instagram photos?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was interesting. Well, first of all, one thing I'll say is, in addition to all of that ephemera that they were showing in advertisements and photos, they also brought some of that horological history into it as well. There were some speakers that got on stage in this first room that we went into, which was, you know, bright and like that ice cave vibe. But they talked about the history of the expedition, which I think was really good context, because I don't know that everybody there probably did all the research beforehand. I mean, it wasn't all just journalists. It was a lot of people that were fans of the brand and stuff like that. And I think some of that is probably deeply nerdy stuff to dig into what an Oyster Prince 7808 model was, and in the center of the room, and I will say this, you know, Tudor being big on history, in the center of the room was the only known 7808 Oyster Prince model that went to Greenland with the logbooks where the explorer took detailed notes about how good of time it was keeping versus the BBC radio broadcast and all this stuff. So, I mean, it was a great thing. And finally, at the end of that, they pulled down these other curtains, you know, curtains on curtains on curtains of the displays. And it was like the watches magically had appeared on these blocks of ice. I was like, oh, I got to get there. I got to get to these watches. But, you know, you don't know, okay, can I remove them from these pedestals and so on and so forth. And luckily, there were all of these event staff that appeared with sort of wooden trays of watches, which also made a nice backdrop to photograph the watches on. And a couple of us were quick to like have these people take these trays down so that we could just, they didn't have to carry them. We could shoot these watches. And surprisingly, for the number of people that wanted these great photos, you know, everybody wanted to make their photos, but everybody was super helpful to each other. I mean, holding reflectors and making sure everybody could get these photos that were good enough quality so that we could provide them to the people that couldn't get hands on. And I'm used to, as a photographer, covering auto shows and stuff like that, where nobody's helpful to each other. Everybody wants their photo, and everybody encroaches on each other's space to get that, which means that nobody gets the photo that they want. And here, Tudor had a bunch of models on every single strap so that we could all sort of spend some time with the watches, photograph the watches, even just wear them around for a little bit, walk around the space, see what it felt like to have them on our wrists.
Sounds pretty chill for a major launch. I mean, you know, my experience at trade shows over the years is like, you know, unless you have a private photo session booked, it's like a lot of sharp elbows, man.
And the funny thing to me was you could tell the writers and journalists and other people that, you know, really had deadlines to meet, from the ones that maybe were waiting until their magazine published, or the, you know, they published once a week or whatever, because yeah. There was a growing line of people waiting to get photos with David Beckham, which of course, being in London, who would be surprised that David Beckham would show up at a Tudor event. But, you know, there was a long line of people that was waiting for those. And I thought, like, you don't have the deadline that I feel like I have to get these photos out in the world, because I ended up not getting a photo with Beckham. And
come on, guys, we've all seen pictures of Beckham. I haven't seen pictures of the new Ranger. Let's get on this. What are we doing?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was my thought, is, you know, I wanted to get photos out there first for social media, for everybody. Yeah. And then, you know, there's something to be said about, you know, creating your own vision of how the watch feels and relaying that through photos instead of relying on the photos that the brand provides. It's something different. So you want to get those as fast as possible.
Yeah, I mean, and the you know, this is something I complain about, not often on this show, but like the brand stuff is renders, typically speaking, right? And or stuff that's so surgically kind of corrected for that it's not really the same. Whereas you put up what I feel is a really solid story with some great photos. And at the time that we're recording this, which really isn't that long, you know, this is 3 days after the story went up, it's got almost 400 comments, which is kind of why I thought, like, we should probably sit down and talk about it. And I absolutely want to dig into the watch, but I have kind of two back questions first. First of all, Mark, this, like I mentioned, this is the first time you're on the show, so I wanted to give you a chance that people get used to your voice. But why don't you give us the elevator pitch on sort of your background in covering watches or working as a photographer or writer, that sort of thing.
My background with watches honestly goes back to when I was, you know, saying my first words, which apparently were tick-tock clock. My grandfather was a pocket watch collector. And so when I would stay with him and my grandmother, he would pull out watches and show me movements and just, you know, do what any watch collector would do, not knowing what to do with a little baby, I guess, is just continue to talk about watches. And, you know, so I have a decent collection of early American pocket watches, and that had always sort of been a passion that had come and gone. And in the interim, I've made my living as a photojournalist, primarily covering everything from business news to long form storytelling. Interned at the New York Times, worked for Time Magazine and Bloomberg and Reuters and others as a photojournalist. And about a year ago, started writing for Hodinkee, kind of marrying my interest in the history of horology and what had been born out of this love of the newer watches, newer than the late 1800s, based on just being an avid reader of Hodinkee for a while and getting this opportunity to sort of marry the two things together. So I have some background with what we would call expeditions, but not really anything to the extreme like the Tudor expedition to North Greenland. But it's nice to kind of bring these two things together finally for me.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think it's a good one. And I think that's a good way to, you know, looking back to the past of the expedition and to older watches and then now new watches. And let's dig into the Ranger. So for anyone who missed the story, I definitely suggest you hit the show notes. It's even in your podcast app and you can link out to it and even scan through it while you're listening. It's a steel case Tudor, 39 millimeters wide, 12 millimeters thick, 47 millimeters lug to lug. You know, it's 100 meters water resistant, sapphire crystal up front. It's all the stuff you know, the stainless steel case back. This time, unlike the previous Ranger, which we will get to, you've got the option of a fully fitted bracelet. It's also a bracelet without rivets and with T-fit, which I think will be a major talking point for a lot of Tudor nerds, especially at this price point. Matte black dial, sort of oversized, hand-painted style numerals, very minimal dial text. I have to really commend them on, like, the bare minimum here, their name and the name of the watch, and let's keep going, right? Like, it really does kind of paint a different aesthetic balance than not only the last one, which was already pretty minimal, but really most other Tudors from the last while, which I think is great. And then for those who are, you know, concerned about this, the last one, of course, had an ETA movement, which I think was fine. But for roughly the same price, you now get an MT5402, which is the same movement as a BB58. So you get the 70 hours of power reserve, no date. It's a 4 hertz movement. And this time it's COSC certified, which I think is also something you should expect from brands operating at this price point and operating in sort of the guise that Tudor operates. Mark, you think I missed anything there in the very, very fast outlay of specs?
No, I mean, that's... That's what I saw in front of me on Friday, so that sounds about right.
Yeah, and on the bracelet, we're looking at just a hair over $3,000, about $27,25 on either of the two straps. So it's that Black Bay Pro style hybrid fabric, rubber leather, or the usual single pass. So it's not quite a NATO. It's made by that French company, Julian Fowler. Again, we did a really great video a long time ago at an inside the manufacturer, you can actually watch these straps being made. If you figure they're the same as the $15 or $20 NATO that maybe you love, I certainly love, these are a whole different weapon. And the cool thing is right at the start, I went to the release here in Toronto, which was just at the Tudor Boutique. They were very clear to say that essentially any strap that fits a BB58 will fit on the Ranger. They didn't want to say whether the bracelet would or wouldn't. Did you guys see, Mark, in the comments for your story, somebody on Reddit has bought the Ranger and then put the bracelet. So now you get T-fit, no rivets on a 58. And unless it's there's some trickery in what they're putting on Reddit, it looks like it fits just fine.
It looked like, I mean, it was, yeah, it looked like it was a perfect fit. And what I thought funny about the comments on that Reddit post was that the person was just planning on just selling his riveted bracelet and just switching the two back and forth, which was funny because they said that they weren't really bothered by the rivets in the first place, which goes to show you, I mean, surprisingly, I think this was my first experience. I did see a Black Bay Pro on the trip, but this was my first time spending a lot of time with the T-Fit bracelet. And I honestly don't blame the guy if he wants to go full in on the new bracelet. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I'm not a huge bracelet guy. It really depends on the quality of the bracelet, but having a micro adjust, and especially one that's like pretty simple, pretty strong, seemingly very strong and easy enough to use, makes like a huge difference for my interest in a bracelet. And I've definitely written in the past about several Tudor sport models and said, like, save your $300 and just wear it on the 20 millimeter straps that you've got, or with the previous Ranger 22 millimeter straps. But I think you'd go with the bracelet, wouldn't you, Jack?
Yeah, I mean, my sort of rule of thumb, unless there's something that I really, really hate about a bracelet, is, you know, always get it on a bracelet because you can always switch it out for a strap, and it's going to cost you more to get the bracelet if you decide you want it afterwards, assuming that you can get one at all.
Yeah, and I guess the other side of it is, like, sometimes you recommend the bracelet purely for if it's a watch that doesn't really hit you that well and you decide to sell it. Most people want the bracelet being the premium option and being too expensive to buy later on, like Jack said. So I think this is an interesting thing. People clearly went crazy for it, like in terms of just wanting to have an opinion. And I think what I found interesting, because earlier today it wasn't 375, 78 comments or whatever. It was like 330 or 340. I went through and read almost all of them. And like, I don't remember the last time that a fairly conventional steel, like maybe the 925, the silver Black Bay, kind of had a pretty divisive play among folks. But like, this is a pretty much down the middle steel sports watch. And like, the comments are pretty split. Some people saying that like it's not enough for them, or it's too close to 1016, which is a very weird comment in my mind. And other people saying like, oh, this is the one I've been waiting for. And I think that kind of stands for some evidence that maybe Tudor made the right move in making some decisions. Mark, how did it hit you? Did you like having it on your wrist? Do you wish it was 36? Do you know, in my case, I just don't understand why it doesn't have drilled lugs. Like, there's like little things about it that are all little choices, but on par, it just seems like a solid sports watch, right? With a good movement and a fair price.
Yeah. I think, you know, there's definitely things that they could have done to make it a little more referential, to make the people that wanted sort of that tried and true Ranger from the 60s and 70s. But look, 39 millimeters is sort of, to me, the sweet spot, not as a personal wearability standpoint, because I wear everything from 34 up to maybe 41, 42 without really feeling that much different about it. And to be fair, I'm 6'7". So I only have a seven.
Outlier.
Yeah. I only have a 7.25-inch wrist, which is something that I really never thought I would say out loud, you know, a little over a year ago, because it wasn't something that I have thought about in the past, but mm-hmm. now it's become sort of a point that you have to know for reference. But I don't think, you know, 36 millimeters, I know how much contention there was when Rolex went to 36 millimeters with the Explorer. And then on the opposite side, you have a lot of contention of them going to 39 millimeters with the Ranger. And I almost wanted to put in the story that the two groups of people really should like have a meetup, get in a room, swap watches, and everybody would be happy, because I think they're very, very similar watches, very similar ethos. Obviously the finishing is going to be different, but I didn't think the 39 was too large. I mean, you're talking about a watch that originally was 34 millimeters, and that goes back to all the Oyster Princes, Oyster Prince dates, Oyster, just plain Oyster models, the manual wounds. They were all in the same case, but you're talking about a modern watch now. And I think, one, you wouldn't get the manufacturer caliber movement into a 34 millimeter case. And two, you know, in all fairness to Tudor, they have to sell watches. And I think this is the right place to put a modern Tudor.
Yeah. And I think they made other concessions for what I would call like the core enthusiast by going no date. There isn't a date option. It's not like this a safety play. They've continued what they've done with the 58, where it's a no date. Jack, I'm curious, because the funny thing is that not only did they change the size, they went down 2 millimeters from the previous Ranger, which you own one. They changed the proportions. So not only was the 41 millimeter Ranger had kind of a much thinner bezel visually, so an even bigger dial, which makes it wear, in my mind, bigger than 41, especially if you wear it. Let's say you switch back and forth between a BB 41, like an original Black Bay. They really wore quite differently. This watch, for me, kind of homogenizes the whole idea of the middle ground of the size of a Tudor. So you still have kind of this big dial that feels kind of explorer-y in many ways. That's probably the 12.369. But how did this hit you versus the one that you might have on your wrist a couple times a month or something like that?
I would really love to see the new one, and I'd really love to try it on. I haven't had a chance to yet. And my first reaction when I saw it was, you know, partly based out of the experience that I've had wearing my Ranger Heritage, which was 2015, still hasn't had a movement. And, you know, I always found that watch, you know, sort of charming. I mean, it's very, very easy. The easiest way to get a rise out of sort of dyed-in-the-wool watch enthusiasts is to do a vintage adjacent or vintage inspired watch, but make it 41 millimeters in diameter. And you can just like, you can, you know, what does Obi-Wan Kenobi say? You can hear a million voices cry out in terror, you know, kind of through the Force. But I always kind of liked it. I mean, this is a separate conversation, but there's a certain class of watch that I think, are appealing precisely because they're kind of goofy, you know, like they're a little too big, or they have these like exaggerated dial features. And, you know, you sort of feel like, you know, on the one hand, they can have the vibe of like, you know, a Chihuahua. And on the other hand, you can have kind of like a, you know, the appeal of a St. Bernard that won't stop drooling on your $27,000 Persian rug. And the Ranger Heritage to me, you know, always had kind of the appeal of the latter. It's like, it's definitely too big, right? I mean, it's 41 millimeters. The dial is enormous. The bezel is really, really narrow, but that's kind of like part of the fun. Oh, and it's got this like big dumb crown tube that sticks out, and like, you know, the crown
was a weird design. They were doing that for a lot, but on the dive watches, they were kind of tucked a little bit under the flank of the bezel.
Yeah. I mean, this is like one of the wonkiest, biggest crown tubes I've ever seen on a modern wristwatch, man. It's like it looks like the barrel of a howitzer or something.
Yeah, in some ways, I remember back when I first saw that watch. I think it came out of Boswell 2014. In some ways, it kind of had like a Panerai vibe. There was just that much dial going on, and I remember liking it and still liking it and enjoying that camo strap. I thought it was pretty fun, and I think the strap options we can get to those in just a moment. For the new one, I kind of missed the camo. I thought that. When I went to shoot a few photos at the Tudor Boutique here in Toronto, I thought maybe they would still do the strap, and I brought a camo kind of like overshirt jacket sort of thing, like an old one. I think that in many ways, as you know, in the file we have for this, the outline for this episode, I've got them photos of them next to each other, and there's so many similarities in the dial and in, especially in the minute hand and the hour hand.
I mean, listen, I love the old one. You know, like I said, I think it's got a certain kind of goofy appeal, and you know, there's I've got a whole like subcategory of watches in the watches that I own that are exactly that. They're just like weird ass watches, but that's the reason that I love them. But I don't think there's any question that at 39 millimeters, without the word rotor wind on the without that on the dial, and at 39 millimeters, they're definitely going to sell a lot more of them. And the fact that it's 1016 adjacent doesn't hurt either. I mean, Mark, what was the vibe in the room when they unveiled the watch? Was everybody too concentrated on gathering media assets, or did you get a sense of how people were reacting to it?
I would say it was hard to judge, just because I mean, they teased this watch with the British North Greenland expedition. They, the last time they used that was when the North Flag came out, which I will say this seems to make a lot more sense to me in the lineup than the North Flag ever did. That was a watch that had portions of the Tudor Ranger. It had sort of an oyster quartz case. It had this bright yellow colorway on the dial in certain parts, and then like almost a more modern font for the 12 and 6. And it never really quite made the same sense that this watch did. And by discontinuing that and the old Heritage Ranger, I think they opened up a very obvious space of what could come next. And so I think the vibe from people, and I'll also say, you know, I think it's better to judge the vibe from the general audience than sort of the watch writers that might be there trying to get their photos, trying to kind of quietly gather their thoughts about, you know, all these things that they're going to have to.
They're a jaded, dead heart bunch as well.
Dead-eyed, soulless.
Yeah. I try to go in with, like, even though it was sort of predictable, like, I try to go in with the hope that I will be excited. You know, I personally Absolutely. Don't want to go in and like you said, be jaded and just, you know, try to be tearing something apart for the sake of tearing something apart. And I think, you know, the general audience that was there was pretty excited about it.
Okay, it's time for our ad break. And anyone who has ever bought themselves a nice watch and then tried to add it to an insurance policy will know just how big a hassle it can be to get your watch insured. You need receipts, an appraisal, a pile of photos, and lots of patience just to get your watch properly protected. Frankly, it sucks, so we decided to make something better. Hodinkee Insurance is the fastest, easiest way to insure the watches you love. Get your quote now at hodinkee.com/insurance.
I don't disagree. I think that makes sense. And it is that kind of watch that we're like if you view it in a vacuum, or you view it on the homepage of a watch website surrounded by other watches that are like very design forward or complication heavy, it looks very conventional, almost in the vein of like, I think we saw comments, which I don't think they're wrong. Like if you asked a kid to draw a watch, they would essentially draw something like a Ranger, right? But I think there's a reason for that. We're talking about essentially something that comes from the bloodline of like the most simple, straightforward mid-century watch design in the steel sports catalog in existence, right? And I think in many ways in 2014 when they did the Heritage Ranger, what they were doing was offering to the same thing of the Explorer vibe that the BB-41 did for a Submariner, which is very much different if you put the two of them next to each other, but somehow similar. Like when you see cousins at a family reunion or something, you go, you can kind of see like, okay, yeah, you two are from similar stock, right? But it's a different thing. And then when you hit the market, when we start talking price, whole different world. A current Explorer 1 is back down to 36 millimeters. It's $7,200. And I genuinely, you know, we say this every time I sit in front of a microphone, I don't know if you can get one. I think your chances are better now than they were 6 months ago, and they might be better in 6 months or a year than they are now. But I still think these are tough things to buy, and I think the Tudor will be tough to buy for a few months.
Well, and somebody in the comments, I don't know if it was on Instagram or in the article, said, you know, about getting a current 36 millimeter Explorer, they said, don't give up hope. My wife got one 2 weeks ago. And then the next sentence was, she put her name in the day it came out. And that doesn't necessarily inspire confidence of not having to wait a long time at the same time that they say, like, it's possible. Well, yeah, it's possible. But here you've got something that's more, I mean, hopefully, I'm sure there will be a demand for a while, but hopefully it'll be more accessible both timeline wise and, you know, price point wise. I think that's something to keep in mind. Is as much as I love writing about the super high horology complicated watches, like, this is a Tudor even, I think, giving more value to the average customer who,
yeah,
a $3,000 watch might be a stretch, and all of a sudden they've got something that is, I think, a lot of value for that.
And I think there's some price context to consider before we go too much further. One, like I hinted at earlier, in 2014, a Ranger on the bracelet was $2,950, right? Almost every watch is more expensive now than it was in 2014, and you're paying $100 more for the brand new one, which has a Kinesi-based movement. So again, you're getting a true no-date movement, 70-hour power reserve, it's still 4 hertz, and it's COSC, and it has that 5-year warranty, which I want to say Tudor didn't have on ETA movements back in the day at that timing. I want to say the 5-year thing started with the North Flag or even maybe a year later. I think that's interesting. The other side of it is so many of the comments focus on whether the aesthetics are like exactly what you would want, whether it's a millimeter or two too big or too small, which is an argument I understand is never going away in watches and I wouldn't want it to, whether or not it should have the rose, whether or not the second hand should be all red, whether or not it should have been a white dial, which would have been closer to the original reference. And that one I absolutely think would have been fascinating to have seen.
I mean, it should have the rose. Let me say it should have the rose. I'm a
dad. That's where you land.
try to. No, I know it's not what they're going to do. And that's like, that's personal preference. I'm a big fan of the rose, but
I don't disagree, but yeah. It wouldn't be that. That's not enough to like be a deal breaker for me.
No, not at all.
I would have loved it with a red rose and an all red second hand.
Yeah, I think there were so many directions they could have gone. In my mind, it's kind of interesting to close your eyes that this isn't, you haven't seen it or whatever, and you just explain to somebody, hey, Tudor's going to be releasing like an everyday sports watch in 39 millimeters with a Kinesi movement and a T-fit bracelet with no rivets, decent loom, 100 meters water resistance, a screw down crown, and it's going to be $3,000. I feel like that checks a lot of the main boxes for people and what they expect from Tudor. Yes, you can get field watches from $350 that are tough and could probably go to Greenland and back. I mean, nobody's fighting and saying that this is the best deal ever in field watches. Moreover, I think it's like a really competitive thing for Tudor within their lineup that seems to offer something that the BB doesn't and then the Pro also doesn't. And that, in my mind, it makes it feel like a good line. I would love to see them expand it, right? Because right now you pay, what is it, like $200 less for a BB36 with an ETA movement? That alone should be evidence of where they're headed, right? Sure, you could get a 36 if that's what's most important to you. And I think those watches have always been really, really sweet. I love that blue dial on the tan leather. But this is like kind of almost fully brushed. It has these really fine marks. Did you notice it's on the BB Pro as well? But on the bezel edge, there's like this absolutely hair-thin polished line around it. There's like two or three small polished elements that, like, when you take the shot in with a macro lens, you can see them. And I like that. I loved it on the BB Pro too.
look, they were obviously very thoughtful about the elements that they put together on this watch. And I keep going back to the North flag, but the North flag was such an oddball to me. Whereas now you see where the brand is heading, and it seems to just make much more sense every time they release a new watch.
Don't get me wrong. Tudor walks themselves into these sorts of comparisons because they made this watch in conjunction with, an event from 70 years ago. So people immediately go, why isn't it 34 millimeters? Why isn't a white dial? Why doesn't it have a rose? And like, they're their own worst enemy if it matters. I'm not sure it actually matters, but that is the communication in the beehive of like deep watch enthusiasm online. If you zoom out just a little bit, this is a really successful evolution of the one that came out in 2014, which was already a reasonably successful watch. It went for 6 years, right?
And I would also say, this for all that the potential downsides of contextualizing their own watches against their own history, we have to keep in mind that there's a lot of watch enthusiasts, fans, readers that maybe haven't been around since 2015 when the North flag came out and didn't really know some of that history. And also, sort of bolsters the ethos that they're trying to put forward right now. And I think as somebody that's a big history geek in that context, I think it's a great opportunity. I mean, I had really interesting conversations with Ross Povey, Tudor collector.
Oh, Ross is great.
And, it was really great to have him there. I mean, I know he was there to work, but it was really great to have him there so I could just ask him both about the 7808, sort of the lineage of the Ranger, which you do a lot of reading, but there's so much information that's sort of a game of historical telephone where things don't necessarily get relayed correctly. And then he just turned his wrist up and said, here's my 7808 that I'm wearing right now. And as you can see, unlike the ones that went to Greenland, this one had a, 12369 dial. So you could find these and this history of the Ranger in these old watches. And by the way, XYZ, really cool fact about these things. And that's stuff that I think, new watch enthusiasts probably might enjoy digging deeper into. And Tudor gives you that opportunity here.
Yeah, and I think that's the other thing that comes along with any of these things is like now that Tudor is entering maybe its second generation of operation in North America, there's some generational knowledge that has skipped because people, like you said, the audience is kind of bigger and different than it was in 2014 for websites, whether it's Hodinkee or anyone else, really. We've grown, diversified, there's been attrition, all that kind of stuff. So you can't always assume that everybody knows the previous story. And I would also co-sign Ross Povey is an absolute gem. He was on the FXD episode, and it's still a conversation that I really enjoyed. And, if we'd had a couple more days to put this episode together, I probably would have tried to have him on with us. He's fantastic and such a great type of nerd. I am curious, did they tell you the backstory on the 7808 that was there?
Yeah, so that was the 7808 that Jason Heaton wrote about back when the North flag came out, and that sort of really interesting backstory. And I can give a brief, I took notes ahead of the episode because I didn't want to get any of this wrong, partially because it's such a cool story. And I want to give, deference and honor to the gentleman that's involved in the story. It was this gentleman named Major Desmond Homard. And he was one of the original members of that expedition to Greenland. The numbers vary. The official number, I believe, is 26 watches that went out on the trip. There were 30 gentlemen in total that went on this expedition. And while they were out there, they had these 26 Tudor watches, which they not only used for telling time, but they used it for navigating the Arctic. Their compasses, traditional compasses, wouldn't work, so they had to use sun compasses and their watches, which had to be accurate so that they knew they could do their calculations for traveling and get to where they needed to safely. I mean, this is a place where the temperature on multiple occasions, they recorded 75 below on 16 different occasions. So it wasn't like, oh, they just had one bad day. This was very difficult. And this gentleman was out there and he, like I mentioned, he kept logs of how accurate his watch was running, but they were, I believe all of them were supposed to give the watches back at the end of the expedition. And he instead gave the watch to his wife, who wore it as he set out on another expedition to Antarctica. And while he was gone, apparently she misplaced the watch. And it took until he was 93 years old, just before the North Flag was released, that he found his watch in a junk drawer in his kitchen. And that eventually made its way back to Tudor, and they had it on display with pictures of he and his wife, and his log that he kept. And a lot of the pictures actually on display at the event were pictures that he had taken. He was a quote unquote amateur photographer, but I mean, there's some of the most incredible, aesthetically incredible photos that I've seen from that period. I just thought it was super fascinating and really cool to see the watch in person.
It's a beautiful watch too, to be clear.
Yeah.
As much as I think the new Ranger works and is probably like commercially more, like I said, down the middle than this specific design, there's nothing about this I wouldn't say they couldn't recreate at some level and be quite successful with it. It would just wear a bit differently than maybe what people expect from a modern sport watch, right?
But I think there's maybe a market for that. I mean, I know, even among just general enthusiasts and people that love the history, but I know that my girlfriend, for instance, is always looking, you know, I'm 6'7", she's 5'1", she looks for small watches. And it is kind of hard to find that smaller, sportier, you know, durable watch that just wears just right for somebody that doesn't want something so big. I think there's maybe a market for a lot of people that would be interested in seeing a 34 millimeter Oyster Prince.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think where I would want to end this is, you know, what do you guys think about folks that are kind of slamming this watch for being kind of too close, but at the same time too far away from something like a 1016?
To be a watch enthusiast is to define like, as in every other form of enthusiasm, is to define yourself as much by what you intensely hate as by what you intensely like.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, there was what was the story that we just published that was Bulgari Ducati collab.
Sure.
And the author had the nerve to bring up the subject of what a cafe racer is. And boy, oh boy, I thought that watch enthusiasts were hyper concerned about high intensity, low impact arguments. I see it's kind of everywhere. And if you're Tudor or if you're Rolex, I think it's impossible to launch any sort of watch without people getting their knickers in a twist about it, either pro or con. It's just kind of the nature of the beast, and it's the nature of the brands, you know what I mean?
I mean, and they're as much at fault as anyone. The lineage is such a selling point. History is such a selling point in watches. Like, they do invite it to a certain point, but I do wonder, like, it seems like if you gave people a list of these specs, like I said earlier, the day before this came out, people would be pretty dang excited about it. And I think people are. This, like I said, the story is super popular.
My favorite comments are always the ones that say, listen, Tudor/Rolex/Omega/giant brand that makes a million watches a year. You have to do this with the seconds hand. You have to do this with a date window. You have to shave 0.1 millimeter off one aspect of one numeral, and then I will buy one. And it's like, they're not trying to sell you a watch. They're trying to sell 500,000 of these watches.
Yeah, basically.
But it makes for great conversation.
Oh, for sure. And it's the heart of what we're doing here, essentially.
Exactly. That's why we're here.
Again, trying to take the positive perspective. You read a lot of comments, and I read a comment that was critical of, like, you know, how close it looks to a 1016, or how it's a slightly lower tier price point. Copying
kind of point, right?
Yeah, I mean, you're literally marketing Hans Wilsdorf's dream for Tudor right back at you. And somebody in the comments responded to one of those saying, like, fantastic compliment to Tudor, and this is exactly what they were designed to do. And maybe 40 years ago they could have had that branching point where they decided to go a completely different direction, but that's what the brand was founded for. I mean, the brand was registered as a trademark in 26 and didn't make watches until nearly 20 years later. I mean, this was an idea for a long time until it started. So to shake that core of what the brand is, I think is, and to expect them to shake that is I think a little bit silly.
That's for certain. I would say that, especially if they even doubled down on that at some point, I would say 2014, when they returned to North America with the Black Bay. I think that was almost like a reestablishing of that original goal. There's a lot of, Jack's dropped some of it in our chat during this call, but there's a lot of weird, goofy, deeply non-Rolex stuff from the brand in their previous years. And people brought it up in the comments. This wasn't a brand that was like renowned among watch enthusiasts when they eventually decided to kind of pull out of the North American market and come back with kind of a new plan. The new plan is kind of the old plan. And in many ways, like I said, I think that I see this this new model as a good rehash of the 2014 Ranger, which is kind of Tudor's Black Bayification of a sort of 1016 or Explorer. And I think it works both to the original impetus and as a watch sort of in a vacuum. I think you compare it to the pricing from 2014. I think that's a big step forward for people and what they pay. And the fun thing is you're within shooting distance of a handful of other watches. BB Pro is $4,000. So add a grand and you can have a GMT of a watch of a similar size, 39, and then a BB 58 is less than a grand more. So really, we're just seeing a lot of options for people from a brand that for a while you kind of had to go 41 or 36. And if you wanted a dive watch, it was 41.
You know what this did make me wonder, though, is about rolling out Meta certification for other models. This would have been kind of a cool watch with Meta cert.
I agree, especially with the historical pin to accuracy, which Mark talked about. I don't know if maybe it's a cost thing. Maybe it's not available on all movements.
I mean, I think it's a scale thing. I had a chance to see their Metis lab, and it's a very small operation right now. There's one very crowded room full of equipment where they test groups of watches for magnetic resistance. And there's a pressure test chamber, and there's the room where only somebody from Metis is allowed to go in order to kind of like certify all the equipment. But it really looked and felt to me like a bit of a pilot program right now, and I don't think that I'm sure that they're going to roll it out in more watches, but it doesn't really surprise me that they didn't roll it out for this one. But it would have been nice though.
And maybe that would be an interesting next story to do. I think that's something that until I started sort of writing about watches and being exposed to sort of the inner workings of how these things work, I had a very gross misunderstanding of how difficult it is to go through any of these programs and get your watches certified. I mean, it's sort of a logistical nightmare for a lot of brands. And so, I, again, another opportunity Tudor presenting to learn a little bit about history or horology or whatever for the people that are interested in that and dive a little bit deeper.
Being that this is a Kinesi movement, which means it's a partnership movement via Tudor. Maybe it's just not something that has, like Jack said, has scaled to the entire range of movements. We haven't seen, to my knowledge, to check, we haven't seen Metis on anything else. Like we haven't seen it in any of the BB58s yet.
I think it's just the ceramic at this
just
point.
The one. Yeah. So
I have a question for Mark. Going from the sublime to the slightly ridiculous. As an American in London, did anyone take exception to how we pronounce Tudor over here?
No, I mean, nobody to my face. Maybe that was, the point of conversation over drinks after the event that, I wasn't around, but.
So apparently the way that you pronounce the name of the royal family is Tudor, not Tudor. Just throwing that out there.
Like with a CH? Like the way I say Toronto?
Like somebody who plays, I guess somebody who plays a trombone is a tutor, but somebody who is a member of a royal family is a tutor. And if you're in the French-speaking part of Switzerland, the brand is Tudor.
I like that one best, I think.
Yeah, I don't know that I'm going to pick that one up, but I'll be spending the rest of the week practicing my terrible British accent for my next trip.
Anyways, on that note, I think that's a show. Mark, it was an absolute pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for swinging out to London and getting the inside scoop on the new Ranger. I really enjoyed getting a chance to see it and even more a chance to chit-chat with you about it. And Jack, hey, I love having you on the show. That's why you're on almost all of them. So thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, guys. Great to talk, Mark.
And yeah, and if you're enjoying the show, you know what I always ask. Send it to a friend, get into the comments, and let us know what we missed about the Ranger, what you might add, what you might change. So with that in mind, thanks so much for listening, and we'll chat to you in about a week's time.